The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Today's broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana features guest speaker Jeff Smullyan, the founder and CEO of Emmis Communications. Smullyan graciously accepted a last-minute request to fill in for scheduled speaker Jalen Rose. In this presentation, Jeff Smullyan discusses media, broadcasting, and the changing digital landscape.
George Farah told me this morning that he was watching Jalen Rose on an ESPN broadcast last night from L.A., and it actually crossed his mind to wonder whether Jalen might not make it today. Incredibly enough, that's exactly what happened. We started getting emails very early this morning that they had canceled his flight because of bad weather on the West Coast. And so he was very apologetic, and we know that Jalen was looking forward to joining us today. But perhaps we'll see him again in the future. And we have been extremely fortunate to have an incredible opportunity with Jeff Smullyan today. Here we have an outstanding local citizen with a national profile who I was asking, just how much do you travel? How lucky did we get? Well, we were incredibly lucky that he happened to be in town without lunch plans and answered his cell phone at 8 o'clock this morning. We know Jeff. Well, maybe he wasn't lucky that he answered his cell phone at 8 o'clock this morning. We know Jeff as the founder and CEO of Emmis Communications, an Indianapolis-based company that owns and operates numerous TV and radio stations across the nation and even around the world. That system includes 20 FM and 2 AM radio stations, 6 regional and national magazines, and radio stations in Slovakia and Bulgaria. I think all that certainly makes him an international media magnate. Jeff is a native of Indianapolis, who actually mentioned to me today his first job was as a copy boy at the Indianapolis Times. But he went on to get undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Southern California and now sits on their board of trustees as well as on the law school council at USC. Many of us remember Jeff as the head of a group that purchased the Seattle Mariners baseball team in 1989 and sold it a few years later. But during that time, he made one move that will ingratiate him to baseball fans forever. He drafted Ken Griffey Jr. and started him on a Hall of Fame career. Now, that may not be quite like Branch Rickey bringing Jackie Robinson to the majors, but it's not far behind. We are incredibly indebted to Jeff for saying yes at 8 o'clock this morning, and I hope that you will give him your warmest welcome. Jeff Smullyan.
Deborah, thanks. I have to admit, this is kind of a strange deal, so at least I'm graded on a curve today because it may be a little rocky. I have a morning ritual. I take my daughter to school, and then I stop and have a quick cup of coffee with my mom. I'm fortunate enough to have a 91-year-old mother, and so stop by and see her. And right before I get to my mother's house, I get a call from Deborah Daniels. Now, usually, if you know my politics, I don't get that many calls from Deborah Daniels. And I'm thinking, the Romney campaign's over, so, you know, there's not much to do here. But she called, and she said, remember we had talked to you about the Economic Club? And I said, yeah. And she said, would you like to do it? I said, sure. And she said, you got 3 hours. So, I'm going to talk about what I think Jalen Rose would want you to know. So let me start. I was coming down the court. I look up. I see Chris Webber call timeout. I go, we don't have any timeout. What is he doing? That's going to be more interesting than the media stuff. But I appreciate that. I love to talk about media. I have been in media, as Deborah said, really since I was a copy boy at the Indianapolis Times in the early 60s. One of my favorite phrases from history, because I was also a history major, was Dean Acheson, who in 1948 said of the Cold War era, we're present at the creation, meaning that this was really the new, the nuclear era, the post-nuclear era, when the world changed and everything was different. What's been fun about my almost 40 years in the media business is that we're present at the creation every day. It changes every day. If you think you've mastered it, I can promise you it will be different tomorrow. The new buzzword in media, I had to laugh. Deborah's talking about it. You've got to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Interactivity is the new buzzword. Everything has to be interactive, even when it might not make sense to be. So I'm going to hold you to that today. And I'm going to ask you to take a part in today's speech. There'll be no cost to you. You just have to raise your hands when I ask certain questions. But I figure I didn't have time to write a speech today, so you guys can help me fill in. And maybe I can explain to you why I think some of our media policy may be upside down, where it's leading, why it is the way it is, why it may not make sense, why maybe it does make sense. But I'm going to start by asking you a series of questions. How many of you read a daily newspaper? Raise your hands. A lot? Okay. I got to tell you, at the Gun and Ammo show, I had about three hands, so it's a different crowd. This is an upscale crowd, let's face it. The Economic Club. What's fascinating about the newspaper business is it suffers from a couple major changes. In 1953, about 85% of 18 to 34-year-olds read a daily newspaper. Today, it's under 10%. We have another problem in the newspaper business, not just declining readership among young people, but what we call, a fancy word, is disintermediation. The classified ad business used to be a major component of the newspaper business. And I'm fortunate every year I do the Aspen Media Institute, and there's always about 40 of us, and you get academic types and business types and regulators. And one guy is there every year. And he's probably, you know, fascinating guy, but one of the most nondescript guys you've ever met. And his name is Craig. And his last name is Newmark. And how many, does anybody know who I'm talking about? Anybody know Craig? Few people know who Craig Newmark is. Craig is a guy who invented Craigslist. I always think if he called it Newmark's List, he would have killed the newspaper business. But by calling it Craigslist, he's taken away billions and billions of dollars of classified ads from the daily newspaper business. And that was really the gravy on which the newspaper business rested. So between younger people not reading daily newspapers and the classified business almost disintegrating, you've really seen a monumental derogation of the value of the newspaper business. I'll give you one example that is kind of stark. In 2001, the LA Times Company sold itself to the Tribune Company, and it sold itself for $8 billion. Now, you probably have read what happened to the Tribune Company in the interim. They went through bankruptcy. After they bought the LA Times, they've just come out of bankruptcy, and they have announced that they will sell not only their own papers, the Times papers, but the old LA Times papers as well as the Tribune. They estimate that the best case for the valuation of the LA Times newspapers that were sold for $8 billion 12 years ago will be about $400 million. So it gives you an idea of what's happened to the economic underpinnings of the newspaper business. It has been replaced, interestingly enough, by things like Craigslist that are really not great businesses. If you look at the overall economic model of Craigslist, it's very limited, almost no profitability. It's really more of a hobby, which is how Craig Newmark likes it. So you've had billions of dollars replaced by really a hobby. And that's a lot of what's happened in all of media today. I'm going to go on to radio. How many of you listen to local radio once a week? All right, this is really appreciated, and I thank you. I'm now going to waive the fee, because I'm so thrilled about that. How many listen to Pandora? See your hands? Okay, would security please remove these people? Pandora, by the way, is a Greek word which means a potential terrorist. You may not know that. No. It's interesting. I've been in the radio business for so long that we've had threats since I started. When I got in the radio business, people said, you guys can't make it because CB radios are going to take you out of the business. There are a few people in this audience old enough, and Deborah, you shouldn't have given away your age, that remember what CB radios are, because most young people go, what the heck is that? Then we went to the 8-track era, then we went to cassettes, then we went to CDs, then we went to Sirius XM, and now we're Pandora. Our challenge in radio is we really have about 93% of all Americans listen to local radio every week. But we have a bigger, maybe a bigger problem than the newspaper problem. We have a perceptual problem. People perceive radio's yesterday's news. And our biggest challenge, and one of the things that we're trying to do to change that, is hopefully get radios on cell phones, which has been sort of my mission, and we're working on that with the rest of our industry. But what's interesting about radio is people think we've been replaced, but we're really very vibrant. But the perception is different. What's interesting about radio is, and it's also true of television, local television is, it's a very efficient distribution model, and I want to talk to you about that a little bit, because it's local, it's free, and local and free are very important to most people. Now, if free isn't important to you, please come up and see me, because there's some things I might want to sell you. But what we see is that the world is sort of talking about what we call a streaming model. Now, I don't know how many of you know what I talk about when I say streaming. Do any of you know? That is Pandora, that is iHeart, that is our radio stations. You can stream every one of our radio stations through the data networks. And that has become a very, very in vogue exercise. Now, I can tell you that at Emmis we've been streaming audio for 17 years, and we love the experience a lot. There's just one little problem. We have never made a profit streaming audio. And by the way, if you think we got problems not making a profit, you ought to see the balance sheet at Pandora. It's a very challenging business model, and I'll give you one explanation to explain why it's challenging. I've got a radio station in Los Angeles, Power 106. Our electricity cost to distribute our signal to all of Southern California is $39,000 a year. So for $39,000 a year, I can send my signal to either one person in Southern California or all 15 million with no incremental cost. If I took my transmitter down and had to send it through the data network, through the internet, my cost to reach my listeners would be over $1 million a year to reach my, actually, almost 3 million listeners a week. It'd be $1 million a year. And their cost would be more than $1 million a year because their bandwidth costs are higher. So same content, same exact listeners, $39,000 versus over $2 million. And by the way, for those of you keeping score at home, that doesn't even include different music royalties I'd have to pay through the internet. So the question becomes, is this an efficient business model? And what we're wrestling with right now is that the American public is sort of in the early stages of this because they don't really focus on this. How many of you have unlimited data plans for your smartphones? Most of you do. All of you. How many have gotten the thrill of being metered? Anybody have metered data plans? A couple. Not many. Okay. It's coming. Let me tell you what it means. It means that the phone business originally went from $30 a month for talk and text to $30 a month for unlimited data. They sort of made a seamless transition. Everybody said, that's great. And then they started noticing that people were consuming a lot of data. How much data has changed? Since the introduction of the iPhone, AT&T's data usage has gone up 21,000%. Think about that, 21,000% in 5 years. Some of you people are nodding. You're experiencing that. Well, what did AT&T say? They said what any great company would say. A great company, or even AT&T would say it. Forgive me. They said, we're going to start charging more. So they started a thing called metered data. Now, most of you have grandfathered plans. It takes a couple years. You go through it. But what that means is every time you listen to something in the data network or watch something in the data network, it's going to start costing you money. This is called the metering plan. Now, I realize I don't want to make this too complicated. But what it really means is that what we've learned is the internet is really the world's greatest information transfer device. And the reason being that we have opened up the ability to transfer information anywhere, at any time, at a relatively cheap cost. The challenge is that what the internet may not be is it may not be the world's best entertainment device. Because when you listen to my radio station or Pandora, or when you watch Netflix, or when you watch anything, YouTube, through the data networks, the costs rack up. The best example, how many of you have an iPad? Most of you do. How many of you have an iPad? Have you watched a live sporting event through it? Some of you have. How many of you have done that not through Wi-Fi, just through your data network? Not many. Okay, a few of you have. Those of you who have you might have noticed something very unusual. And that is that if you have a $30 or $40 a month data bill, if you watch one ball game through the data network, you ate it all up. So we've had people say, gee, I love the Masters the other day. I watched three holes, and I went through my entire $43 a month data plan. That is where the world is going. So the question becomes, everybody talks about video and audio, and the question really is, and government has said, we want broadband to be the wave of the future. And a lot of people are saying, wait a minute. It may be that broadcasting, for most forms of entertainment, is actually more efficient. This is really going to be the coming debate. If you follow government policy, you know the FCC has decided they want to take a lot of spectrum from TV stations, and they want to put it into the data networks. Reed Hunt, who was the chairman of the FCC, who was the architect of all this, said, we must free America from the tyranny of the major broadcast companies, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, Time Warner. There is a tyranny there. So we are going to open it up to this egalitarian world where everything is open and everything is distributable and everything is wonderful. And I had lunch with Reed about a year ago, and he's a good friend, known for a long time. And I said, Reed, how does it feel to know that this egalitarian world ended up in the hands of AT&T and Verizon? And by the way, they're going to start to charge the American public billions and billions and billions of dollars for the same stuff that those rascals at CBS and NBC gave you for free. And he said, unintended consequence. So it is an interesting part of policy, and there really is the debate is, how will you consume? Let me ask you some questions about TV, because data metering comes into TV too. How many of you have cable? How many of you have satellite? How many of you had nothing? All right. And that, again, this comports with averages of the American public, that about 95% of people have cable or satellite. What we're seeing is a trend, and the trend is people are starting to question it. How many of you watch more than 20 channels? Nobody. How many people watch between 10 and 20 channels? Few. How many watch under 10 channels a week? Congratulations. You're paying for 500 channels, folks. You're watching less than 10. How can this be? Wait a minute. What about those other things that I don't watch? Well, you're part of what I have always called the world's greatest cross-subsidy. The American television business for the last 21 years has been based on the premise that people will pay for what they don't watch and don't have to pay for what they do watch. It's a wonderful business model. Why did it get created? It got created because when the government changed the rules in 1990, I'm trying to go fast here because a lot of you have planes to catch Deborah said, if you're not off the stage at 1:05, we're going to shoot you, so I got to be quick.
No, not
but
sure.
We're okay. But basically, what's happened is a business was built where the cable industry, Time Warner, Comcast, Cablevision, et cetera, or whatever, was married sort of with the content producers, ABC, NBC, CBS. Sometimes they were even the same company in the last 20 years. So what they said is what we really need to do is we need to make sure that we keep giving people more product, and we create what we call the bundle. So if you say I watch 10 channels a week, they say that's great, but we really would like you to pay for 100. And when people said, I'm not thrilled about that, they said, good, then you'll pay for 200. And then you'll pay for 300 and 400. It was called the bundle, and it worked really well because the cable industry sold a lot of more expensive product, and the broadcast industry kept creating new networks. So you don't have Nickelodeon, you have Nickelodeon 1, you have Nickelodeon 2, you have Nickelodeon preteens, you have Nickelodeon's kids who are homeschooled, you have ESPN 9, you have ESPN Cincinnati, you have ESPN Dayton. So you have all these line extensions, and they all go, if you look at, how many of you actually, have you ever gone through your 500 channels? There's stuff you've never heard of, but it gets paid. It gets a little sliver. And finally, somebody said, wait a minute. Maybe I can live without all this. Maybe I'll cut the cord. Show me again the hands of people who don't have cable. Did you, very few of you, did you cut the cord? Did you say, I want to live with Netflix, right? Okay. People said, you know what? I want to live with Netflix. I don't need all this stuff. And by the way, I can get all the local stations, 4, 6, 8, 13, 59, always remember the local stations, by putting a little antenna up. Any of you remember, did your great-grandparents tell you about what an antenna was? It's just real simple. You can get it for free. So people started doing that. Then the cable industry said, wait a minute. they had two responses. Wait a minute, we're not thrilled with this. Maybe we'll start selling what we call a la carte. You pay for what you want. Or they said something else even more profound. They said, okay, let's pick a name of a company, Comcast. And you've just canceled my $139 500 channel thing because you want to watch Netflix. And you're paying me $39.95 for broadband, right? Maybe let's charge you $69.95 for broadband. And maybe if enough of you do that, we'll charge you $99.95 for broadband. And then maybe people will meter your... Now, people, I've talked about metering data in the wireless world, but now we're talking about metering data in the wired world. So if we know that a lot of Netflix and a lot of stuff, YouTube and all that stuff's going through your pipe, we're just going to meter you a little bit. So this is what's fascinating about all this. Now, how many of you are sports fans? All sports fans. I got bad news for you. Better news than if you own the Pacers or the Colts, but bad news. Here's the challenge. This has really been the prime beneficiary of this whole system has been sports. Sort of why we got into Major League Baseball, why we get out, but anyway. I guess I should ask the question. You all have ESPN. It's a constitutional obligation. You must have ESPN. You may not know that of your cable bill, you spend $6 a month for ESPN. Did you know that? How many of you knew that? Raise your hand if you knew that. We're going to have some really angry non-sports fans who realize it's great for a sports fan. For $6 a month, it's great. Now, if you're a 90-year-old grandmother living in Phoenix and you don't know there are Arizona Cardinals or Phoenix Diamondbacks, what happens when you realize that for the last 20 years you've been paying an ever-increasing amount of money for ESPN? Maybe you'll cut your cord. Maybe you'll start to call your congressman. The proliferation of sports is making this more pronounced. I'll give you an example. In Southern California, the Dodgers just did a new deal which will charge $5 a subscriber for the Dodgers every month, 12 months of the year. Now, for those of you who watch Major League Baseball, you know they only play 7 months of the year, and the Dodgers only about three of those seven. But you're going to pay $5 a month all year. So if you're in Southern California, we know that studies show that 175,000 people watch Dodger games, but 5 million cable subscribers are going to pay for them. That's along with the $6 a month for ESPN. That's $3 a month for the Angels. That's $2 for the Ducks and the Kings, and hopefully for the Pacific 12 Network, of which my wonderful university is a part, another $2 a month. Well, pretty soon people are paying $20-some dollars a month for sports. If you don't like sports, at some point you're going to say, what is this all about? That's what the debate is about. Will the bundle unbreak? Will you be able to pay for just what you want? And will that destroy the economics? The entire sports business, folks, has been based on one thing. Well, there's a couple things. One is that we keep getting a great quarterback, which we're fortunate to have. But the second thing is that you can universally distribute all sports across the entire population with people who passionately love sports and people who don't care. 100% distribution. If that ever changes, it's going to be a different economic landscape. It's going to be a different economic landscape. And all of it is really in the hands of you. Because if you make enough noise and you say, I don't really want to do this, then it will change. It's a changing landscape. I've talked too long, and I know we got questions, but I thank you. And I think Deborah said that refunds for the people who came looking for Jalen will be available outside. Thank you all.
That was tremendous, and we so appreciate it. Now, you know, I had written down a question before you got to this, okay. Jeff. And my question was, is there any chance of consumers forcing the cable companies to break this vise? You know, is there a way to do it? And you said, well, it's in your hands, but is that realistic?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it is and it isn't. You know, I am part of the broadcasting system. That I always marveled. I got into television because we said, gosh, how can it be that in every survey, the top four things that people care about are ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, and yet they get no money, and there are channels that nobody's ever heard of that get 30 or 40 or 50 cents a month. People are finally starting to cut their cords, and if they cut their cords, then all of a sudden you may break up. It's been a really a marriage of convenience between the cable providers and the content providers. But it may be that if it breaks up, you're going to force some changes. That's a short answer to a very long question.
You know, we talked a little about newspapers.
Yes.
How long can hard copy newspapers really be expected to last? And maybe that's a question. You know, how many people? You know, you asked how many people read the newspaper every day. Well, we do, but
Last time I gave this similar speech, I was looking at Clay in the audience. I'm going to look at him again because one of the questions has been, if the economic model doesn't work, you've got two choices: foundations or governments. I don't know about the tyranny of the foundations. I'm not thrilled about government owning newspapers. And as a lifelong broadcaster, people say you must be thrilled the newspaper business is collapsing. And I go, yeah, it's really great for all us broadcasters, and it's going to destroy the democracy. Because if you don't have newspapers that are watchdogs, and I fervently pray that we find an economic model for the newspaper business. Because I've had several politicians say, you know, if the newspaper business goes, we're out there on our own. And I'm thinking, you mean it could be worse than now? So,
how do you reach? And this is an issue that the Economic Club has been facing with this format.
Yeah.
And we talk about it all the time. In your business, how do you reach the younger generation that isn't really using that vehicle anymore?
Well, that's the challenge. You know, we always talk about the fact that, you know, kids, they don't read newspapers because they just consume The Economist and The New York Times online. I get worried. I mean, I will be honest. You know, we used to do studies in the radio business, you know, where, you know, 25 years ago we had the top of the hour news. And every time we did research, it's like, don't give me the news. I don't care if there's a nuclear missile that hits in Glendale and I'm coming up Keystone Avenue, it's 59th, let me know. If not, tell me what Madonna's doing. And I can't tell you it's not depressing, but over and over again we see that. And I don't know, you know, we're talking about education. I mean, I'm hoping that we will start educating people who realize that in a global economy, we got to compete. I'm hopeful.
Now, this is a question that I will tell you Lloyd Wright did not submit.
Okay.
What is your position on public broadcasting? Should it receive governmental funding, and do you see public broadcasting as a competitor? I just asked the question.
I want to give a flippant answer, like off of their heads. The reality is I am frightened by the fact that we are, and I'm frightened by the debate about public broadcasting. So, Lloyd, you know where I stand on this. I think it's a critical part of the country. I think public broadcasting system and public radio has done a great job. Hopefully they fill niches that we can't, and they do a pretty darn good job of it. And I think the idea that we are going to blow up support for public broadcasting for, you know, it's like when people say, you know, we're going to fix this country, we're going to cut foreign aid. Because that's where all the waste is. And you see studies of people say, well, they want to cut foreign aid, and foreign aid is about 0.01%. It's not our problem. It's small. Same with public broadcasting. I think public broadcasting provides a very valuable service. I've now got 3 children who have grown up with public broadcasting. I'm not sure whether that's a pro or a con, but that's another story. No, but seriously, I think the things you do are great, and I fervently support public broadcasting.
Well, with that, I want to thank you for a tremendous presentation and
Thanks.
For stepping into the breach for
Thanks,
us.
Deborah.
We are so grateful.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks.
Please join us next month on Wednesday, May 15th, as we wrap up our 2012-2013 season and welcome Alma Powell, a chair of America's Promise Alliance, an alliance of national organizations dedicated to teaching today's youth. Please be sure to go online at economicclubofindiana.org and order your tickets for that luncheon today. I hope you'll join me once more in thanking Jeff Smullyan, and have a wonderful day. We'll see you next month.
Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.